Coming up on Fronteras, residents are waiting on the opening of a formal border crossing linking Rio Grande Village inside Big Bend National Park and the Mexican Riverside Village of Boquillas, Mexico.
As you can see, the gate is locked. Number of security cameras in place.
Also on today's program, a large national community health providers launching an interesting way to provide HIV awareness. Telenovelas for YouTube.
Mija, ¿qué pasa?
Cesar is going out again tonight. Mama, I think he's cheating on me.
Educating Latinos about the spread of HIV and the need for universal testing. But first, the news. This is Fronteras, a journalism project that covers the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras was created via an unprecedented multimedia collaboration among seven public radio stations and funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of its local Journalism Center initiative. I'm Crystal Chavez. The exact date is uncertain, but all signs point to the opening of a formal border crossing linking Rio Grande Village inside Big Bend National Park in West Texas and the Mexican Riverside Village of Boquillas, Mexico. People on either side used to cross freely by wading across the Rio Grande, but in a post-9/11 world, the United States declared all so-called informal border crossings illegal. Lauren Madelon has more from Big Bend National Park.
Ay, 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 ay. Canta y no llores.
The border may be sealed at Boquillas, Mexico, but the solitary sound of a Mexican man singing doesn't need a passport to cross into the United States. The man asks in Spanish, "Do you want to hear more music?"
¿Quiere otra canción?
¿Cómo no, hombre?
De la Sierra Morena, cielito.
So undoubtedly, many of the people listening to this broadcast have been here, made the crossing prior to 2002, when this border was sealed up in a post-9/11 world. And it's both exciting and frustrating to be standing here. The cliche says a stone's throw away. That's exactly what I am right now from Mexico, with people on the other side, clearly friendly, anxious to talk, unable to cross, as we are, and will continue to be, until the official reopening takes place.
As you can see, the gate is locked. Number of security cameras in place.
No one knows why the opening's been delayed, but few people have documented those delays the way John Waters has. He's the publisher of the Big Bend Gazette and a former Park Service biologist. He's also filed several Freedom of Information Act requests, known as FOIA requests, to find out why the opening of the port of entry's been delayed repeatedly. Waters hasn't received an explanation, but as someone who clearly loves this land, Waters says the reopening will add an important dimension to visiting the Big Bend.
And that dimension is the ability to not only visit a national park, but to visit another country.
We met a hiker, Todd out of Dallas. He believes it makes economic sense to open the border in tiny villages like Boquillas.
Increase trade. I think there's a lot of people on this side and that side that can do things together. And there's a lot of area over there I'd love to be able to go visit, too.
Again, John Waters.
This is interesting. I was down here not even 2 weeks ago. And when I came down here 2 weeks ago, this interpretive sign was not here. So more and more see progress towards this being open. And here we are in front of this interpretive sign, which is titled An Open Door, Boquillas, a village on the edge of two countries. So that's a positive development.
I spoke with Boquillas resident Jesus Padilla. 60 years old, friendly, he stands by the shoreline in a faded blue baseball cap and a red checkered shirt. Padilla says Boquillas is counting the days until the crossing becomes legal. He says if they open the border here in Boquillas, people will benefit on both sides. Visitors will buy food and souvenirs in my village, and I'll be able to buy things in the U.S.
There's another interesting underreported aspect to this story, and that has to do with the benefits of an open border, what the United States can learn by having open lines of communication with the people on the other side.
A number of park service employees have told me that prior to the border being closed or the laws being enforced, that there was a greater amount of intelligence by having an open border, where if something was amiss, the lines of communication were open, and the Park Service could more effectively communicate with Mexican nationals and find out what was happening across the river and also along the river in the U.S.
Some analysts believe that tiny, isolated villages don't pose a security risk to the United States. Boquillas, for example, is a dangerous and tedious drive to the nearest Mexican town. It has far more in common with the U.S. than it does with the rest of Mexico. But when the crossing becomes legal, people will still need a passport or Western Hemisphere-compliant document like a passport card. We asked Mexicans if they had a passport. All said no.
Years ago, there used to be a Good Neighbor Day here in the park where people from the park and local communities would come down to the river and celebrate with people from Boquillas. Good Neighbor Day, not going to happen. And one of the Mexican nationals that I was speaking to across the river said, Señor Bin Laden changed things.
Here's the security risk in a nutshell. Would a terrorist or smuggler risk crossing hundreds of miles of inhospitable territory in Mexico only to face a long, heavily patrolled trek through equally tough terrain in the Big Bend National Park? Most people in law enforcement say the answer to that is absolutely they will take that risk. Supporters of the reopening say that's unlikely and that security in such a remote place is trumped by the desire to normalize ties with an isolated village of 120 people. I'm Lorne Madelon in Big Bend National Park.
Investigators in Tijuana have made a gruesome discovery over the last week, but it's one that gives hope to families in Baja California whose loved ones have been kidnapped or disappeared. Authorities have located two mass graves containing potentially hundreds of dissolved human remains. From our Fronteras desk, Aaron Siegel has more.
Here in the neighborhood of Ejido Maclovio Rojas, Tijuana, most residents have neither electricity nor running water. On a street called Calle Siowak, at the peak of one hill, sits a small property known as La Gallera. La Gallera was supposedly a cockfighting ranch. Neighbors say no one's lived here for years. One man told me the people who used to come to the ranch weren't from here.
They were all new cars, and in this town you can't drive cars like that. And those kinds of cars were coming, like new trucks.
La Gallera's hilltop location offers a panoramic view of the surrounding dusty valleys filled with makeshift homes. This is one of the poorer parts of Tijuana, isolated and largely left alone by police.
Es un lugar excelente para hacer cosas del crimen organizado.
That's Fernando Osejuera. He says this is an excellent place for those involved in organized crime. He's the founder of Baja California's Association for the Families of the Disappeared.
It's
very important for us to know about this location. It represents a lot of hope for a lot of people. There are still families looking for their sons and daughters for 5-6 years.
The number of people who remain missing in Mexico due to organized crime is estimated to be as high as 25,000. In the state of Baja California, Fernando Osejuera has been leading the search for 5 years. His own son Fernando went missing in 2007. This body dumping site at La Gallera was revealed by Santiago Mesa, the man known as El Pozolero, or the Stewmaker. Mesa worked for drug cartels in Tijuana at the height of the city's drug violence. He dissolved bodies of people who had been executed or kidnapped in acid.
El pozolero no es el único.
The Stewmaker isn't the only one who dissolved bodies in acid.
Victor Clark Alfaro of Tijuana's Binational Center for Human Rights says that the sites named by El Pozolero are just a few of many undiscovered mass graves across Mexico. El Pozolero was captured in Baja in 2009 and has confessed to dissolving 300 people. Today, in front of La Gallera, soldiers stand guard behind yellow caution tape. The whole block is cordoned off. Federal officials supervise specialists brought in from Mexico City. They're carefully removing fragments of bone and teeth from the gelatinous mass of human remains. Fernando Osejuera has been here at the site every day. Sometimes he just stands alone, smoking Marlboros and watching. Other times, families join him. After 5 years, the authorities know him well. He was allowed onto the property to take photos. He describes the uncovering of the pits.
This container where the bodies are is a cell that is 4 meters long by 4 meters wide.
As of Friday, over 100 people's remains had been found. Outside the crime scene parameters, other people visited. Jessica Rodriguez Espinosa and her cousin, Karina Landy, lost 8 family members to kidnappings. They were seized during a barbecue in Tijuana on September 21st, 2007. Both women's husbands were taken. They've been visiting La Gallera to watch the investigation's progress.
We are here because for 5 years, our relatives have been gone. We feel bad because we wanted to find them alive. But after 5 years already, no.
Although the excavation at La Gallera was supposed to end on Tuesday, it will now continue through this week due to the amount of human remains found. Standing in front of the site earlier this week, while a rare mix of rain and sun created a rainbow overhead, Jose Huera told me that he's hopeful.
We are very happy that finally, at last, we have new hope. The hope is in the DNA.
He also hopes that La Gallera can be turned into a monument to the people whose remains were found there. From Tijuana, I'm Aaron Siegel.
There's still more Fronteras coming up, an effort to provide HIV awareness through telenovelas.
Yeah, ¿qué pasa? Cesar is going out again tonight. Mama, I think he's cheating on me.
Educating Latinos about the spread of HIV and the need for testing. Stay tuned. This is Fronteras. I'm Crystal Chavez. One of the nation's largest community health providers has launched an original series of telenovelas for YouTube. KPCC's Stephanie O'Neill says they're designed to educate Latinos about the spread of HIV and the need for universal testing.
In the world of Spanish language TV, the telenovela reigns supreme. These Latino soap operas are rife with scandalous family dramas that keep viewers coming back. And the plotline of Altamed Health Clinic's telenovela web series, Sin Vergüenza, or Without Shame, is no exception. Natalie Sanchez is HIV prevention manager for L.A. and Orange County-based Altamed, which produced the original series of 4 YouTube telenovelas to educate Latinos about HIV and the importance of universal HIV testing.
The telenovelas really capture what's central to Latinos, which is the family. And so in the telenovelas, you'll see an unraveling of the different issues that impact Latinos.
The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention provided Altamed with a grant of nearly $400,000 to hire a writer, a director, and a cast of bilingual actors for the 7-minute productions that weave their HIV plotline through the lens of the fictitious family Salazar.
It's highly connected to the stories that we hear on an everyday basis here at the clinic from our patients who are HIV infected.
Hilda Sandoval is a program manager for Altamed's HIV unit and a co-writer of the series, now airing on YouTube in both English and Spanish.
The telenovela focuses on one family unit, but it really ties into some of the issues that no one really wants to talk about.
Like homosexuality, infidelity, and risky sexual behaviors, one of which, by the series' close, will lead to a member of the Salazar family becoming infected with HIV. In the first minutes of episode 1, viewers wonder if it might be the Salazar's son, Enrique, a law student who lovingly embraces his gay lover, a young doctor, within full view of dad's disapproving eyes.
Mama always wanted me to marry a lawyer.
And I always want to marry a doctor.
First-year intern, well, we'll get there.
Less than a minute later, though, viewers learn that the family mother, Adriana Salazar, is also potentially at risk, as it seems her husband, Cesar, might be spending his evenings with another lover.
Yeah, ¿qué pasa? Cesar is going out again tonight. Mama, I think he's cheating on me.
And not even the widowed grandmother, Salazar, is safe from the risks of HIV exposure, as evidenced by this scene.
Well, I'm off to the senior center. It's bingo night, and I'm feeling lucky.
Ooh, Ooh, lucky, because Mom says Señor Rodriguez is going to be there.
Oh, maybe you'll get really lucky, Grandma.
Yeah.
Cállense, los dos.
The grandmother also is facing really a turning point in her life. She's dealing with going back into the dating scene, not knowing what to do after being a widow for 10 years.
Again, AltaMed program manager Hilda Sandoval.
A lot of times we forget that our elder population really do have a life beyond, you know, their 60s and 70s, and they do go back and start dating. So we really wanted to address that because HIV does not discriminate in age. It affects different members of our community. And so we really wanted to depict what we see happening in our community.
Episode 1 of Sinvergüenza is now airing on YouTube. It'll be followed by the release of Episode 2 in mid-December and Episodes 3 and 4 in January.
That was KPCC's Stephanie O'Neill reporting from Pasadena. The holiday season is upon us, and for many that means carrying on the Christmas tradition of making tamales. Ellen Riojas-Clark is Professor Emeritus of Bicultural Bilingual Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio. She's also a longtime tamale maker. Clark will help lead the Guadalupe Cultural Arts Center's annual Grand Tamalada Saturday morning.
At the Tamaladas, where you get together with everybody, your family, your friends, even strangers, people you like and people you don't like, and participate in a communal, familial, historical event making tamales. And that's what a tamalada is.
Now, give me just a brief description of how to make a tamale. How do you make a tamale?
Well, the most interesting part, and this is, I think, what I tell my grandchildren every year and people that I meet, is that you make tamales the same way they were made thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. So you just take a natural product like a corn husk, not a leaf, but a corn husk, and you soften it and you spread it with masa, which is a dough made out of corn, and then you spread it with whatever you want. So if you like chicken, you put chicken in it. If you like beef, you put beef in it. If you like pork, you put pork in it. And if you like them sweet, you put that in it. So it's a corn husk, dough, a filling. You wrap it up, you steam it, and then you open it up and enjoy.
And there's so many different kinds, like you were talking about, based on the regions they come from.
Correct. Absolutely. So, and there's different ways to make them. We in San Antonio like small, tiny, exquisite little tamales with a little bit of dough and meat in it. And then you go other places and you get big fat ones. And so you just need to eat one, or you can eat half a dozen or a dozen of the little tiny ones. So size and filling depends upon where you live and where you're from.
Now, tamales are a big holiday tradition, and there is much about family as just cooking. It's really, like you said, a communal thing.
Yes, it definitely is. Well, number one, it's such a labor-intensive job. I mean, it's not a job, a labor-intensive event. So you want to have as many people help. And then the other is just a very joyful time because it is the holidays. And then you're involved in making something that's very, very special. That now, I mean, tamales you can eat any time of the year. But to make them is an event that should be a family and families.
Yes, in my family, my grandmother gets all of her daughters, granddaughters, everyone goes to the house and we all sit there and spread the masa and talk and catch up.
Right.
And what memories do you have?
Well, I love what my sister says. My sister says the tamales ain't good if the gossip ain't good. So you have to have good gossip. And I think that's part of it. And there's just what I like about it is that it's a traditional thing. It's something you do every year. And it's something that for me as a Mexican-American, it's part of my history. It's part of my tradition. And it's part of my family. And that makes it an enjoyable event to have people come together for that.
As you mentioned earlier, there's a lot of hard work involved.
Yes.
It's a big task. With all of these new kitchen gadgets coming out, is there anything that's come out that makes it easier to make tamales?
Okay. I'm going to tell you some secrets, but don't tell anybody, okay? Because I used to make 150 pounds of masa just at my home to have tamales for all my students and everybody that I knew. I came upon washing my hojas, which is the corn husk, in my top-loading washing machine because that is probably the hardest job to, because to soften them, you have to wash them, you have to clean them, and then you have to soak them in hot water. So as soon as the water gets cold, you take the cold water out, you fill it up with hot water again. So you can imagine the drudgery and the hardship on your hands. So I thought, hey, wait a minute, the washing machine has the hottest water possible. So I run some vinegar through the washing machine to get rid of all the soap residue, put the hojas in it the night before, fill it up with hot water, do not agitate, and then spin them. When the water gets cold, you spin it and you fill it up with hot water again, and you just continue doing that all day long.
What about spreading the masa? That's also really hard.
Well, that's why you bring in everybody.
There you go. More hands.
More hands, exactly. More hands. And people used to think I was a perfectionist, and I just figured out after a while, it doesn't matter what they look like. You know, people spread in different ways. So, you know, people put thick masa, they don't spread it well. Does it really matter? No, because it's the event. It's a coming together.
Some families have secret recipes. Is this like a thing with the malas? Do the recipes go down generations? Are there?
It's an oral tradition, absolutely. They're not written down. And so people say, my grandmother made the best ones, and I just can't do it. And I said, well, what you do know is what they tasted like. So she might not have given you the recipe, but just remember the taste and just keep adding, experimenting with it, and you'll get the taste. And it'll be your taste, really. But that's just as important to start.
Ellen Riojas Clark is Professor Emeritus of Bicultural Bilingual Studies at the University of Texas at San Antonio, also a longtime tamale maker. You've been listening to Fronteras, a Corporation for Public Broadcasting-funded journalism project covering the U.S.-Mexico border region, immigration, and the rising Latino demographic. Fronteras is a collaboration of public radio stations KJZZ Phoenix, KPBS San Diego, KNAU Flagstaff, KNPR Las Vegas, KRWG Las Cruces, KUAZ Tucson, and KSTX San Antonio. Fronteras is online at fronterasdesk.org. We're also on Facebook, and we invite you to join the conversations there and post your thoughts about our stories. For headlines and updates, you can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is Fronteras Desk. You may also subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Our theme music was composed by Charanga Cakewalk. I'm Texas Public Radio's Crystal Chavez. Thanks for listening.